Fans, we are back live with another edition of the Cheap Heat Productions Pro Wrestling Podcast. My name is Jack Kilby, Executive Vice President of Great North Wrestling, and we're very pleased to welcome tonight to the podcast an individual who has a very unique perspective on quite a chunk of time of the former WWF, now WWE, a former creative director, now known, which we'll get into, formerly known as the art department, now creative services. She was with the company from 90 to 2005 and started just before WrestleMania 6 in Toronto. And I would be talking about Deborah Jazway. Deborah, thank you for coming on tonight and welcome.
Thank you. It is a pleasure. I'm a little overwhelmed by all of the interest in myself and that little unique slice of what I bring to the table. It's not every day that a graphic designer goes on podcasts to talk about their experiences from like 30 years ago, but you know, it was a very unique place to work, and what we did was pretty different. So we do have some really good stories to share, and I'm really happy to do that. So thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And we're all about, telling stories on this broadcast of individuals in the wrestling business who have, perform not only in front of the camera, but behind. We've done a number of these, so looking forward to this. But before we get into the questions, I must throw to the man who is known as Mr. Cheap Heat, the man who is a budding public servant, a very motivated individual, a man who has got many irons in the fire, but here to join us today on his own show. And I would be talking about Morris Shorthall. Morris, welcome again to your own show.
Thanks very much, Jack. See, Deborah, what we do is we stream this from Canada because Jack's internet is better than mine. So we go from Canada, yeah. Ireland, USA, everywhere else.
Makes sense.
Yeah. I think it's as good a place to start as any. If you would talk about, how you came to work for Titan Sports by way of your background. It's still, as you touched on, a unique calling, and the fans would be very interested in getting that background.
I was 24. It was probably my first real job out of college. I applied to an ad in the paper, Help Wanted, and I think they described it as a athletic company. So I thought maybe I would be doing package design on tube socks or something like that, or basketballs. And I remember showing up at the headquarters and walking down the hall, and I remember just seeing all of the frame posters of the Ultimate Warrior, and everything was just larger than life. It was stepping into Wonka land. I'm like, this is not what I was expecting. And I got hired as a, I guess you could call, a paste-up artist. And this is going back, again, not only has wrestling changed, but my industry, graphic design, has changed exponentially. So that was my first real job, was kind of helping as an assist, working on the menial work. I used to work in the dark room, small little things that you would not understand how much technical handwork went into producing mechanicals to create print artwork, whether it was licensing artwork that was sent out for, say, featuring superstars' images on cereal boxes or ice cream bars, up to our posters that promoted the pay-per-view events. So it was a very hands-on, very different world technically back then, and it's changed so much while I was there. I was literally working in the department the day we all got our very first Macs, our computers, and we were what do I do with it? And they sent us to classes, and we all learned how to work in the programs. And so when I look back at some of the stuff that I've saved, I have a box of treasures, and I've got some old mechanicals that you would not believe how primitive it is. So when I pull up some of my old work, I'm almost embarrassed, but we did what we could with what we had to work with. And again, it went from a kind of a carny traveling circus, product back then, to this, multimedia, powerhouse, incredible show that it is today. I'm somewhere in the timeline way back here. So I stand back in awe of what they do today, you know? So again, when I share out some of my stuff, I'm kind of like, it's kind of cringy, but it's like, this is what we did back then. We worked with what we had and, you know, we still got the job done, but things were so different back then. But, oh, you know, what a weird, wonderful place to cut your teeth as a young graphic designer. I didn't know what the real world was like. I thought this was what everybody did when they went to work. So it was an incredible place, incredible opportunities for someone like me. I, you know, grew up there basically. And I mean, I worked on things that literally were, you know, taking a logo, printing it on adhesive paper and putting it onto one of the vending machines in our cafeteria. And then that same day, you know, sending out a file that was going to be a banner hung on our restaurant in Times Square. So as an art department, you know, we changed our name to the Creative Services Department because we did so much more. We did everything. And, you know, and one other thing that Brian had touched on when we did our last podcast was, we did everything directly in line with Vince McMahon. He had his hands on everything, right down to all of the creative input. So everything that we did went right to Vince, and either he liked it or he loved it. But that was where our circle of creative extended out to. It was our art department, and then it went to marketing. And once marketing approved it, it went to Vince. So it was very, very hands-on in all aspects. So a lot of fun.
So like what everyone says about Vince is like he's got his finger kind of in everything. Like what kind of experience did you have working with him over the years?
Well, again, it was we had weekly meetings. So I was in charge of pay-per-view marketing and what we were going to be presenting for our pay-per-views every month. So as a team, we would all brainstorm. Sometimes it would be like the name of the event, you know, like say No Mercy. And I had a thesaurus that I would take out. We would sit in our brainstorming sessions. You would think, how many ways can we say aggression? Like, we got to come up with a new word. So, you know, I have to pull that thesaurus out somewhere. But we would sometimes, you know, brainstorm the actual name of an event. And we would give Vince a list. And I would meet with him. And he would go down the list. And he would pick a name right then and there. We would come up with a couple of ideas. And we would concept them out about who the main event was going to be and what they would look like on that. You know, maybe it featured an electric chair, or maybe it was, you know, Vince holding something and he was going to, we would brainstorm out of the box ideas and we would give him like maybe two or three safe ones and always something like really, really weird just to show him that we were, you know, thinking, and he would get a kick out of it. But, you know, 9 times out of 10, Vince would pick what he wanted, but he would make it better. Like, he always had that extra creative juice that he added to something. And you were like, oh, you know, why didn't we think of it? It's like, that's how creative. He was a creative genius, and he was really, really impressive to work with. So that was what we did. As my experiences with Vince were, again, like every week we would meet with him, we'd go around the table, and he would approve stuff that was done for, say, merchandising, t-shirt designs, and he would go around the table, and then he would get to, you know, pay-per-view and marketing, and then I would show him, you know, this is the latest, you know, that we're, you know, proposing for this pay-per-view or this ad or however. So he was hands-on with all things for as long as I was there.
We've heard a lot about, mostly from the broadcast folks, about banned words that Mr. McMahon had, including, you know, a title belt was never to be called a strap, and even down to pro wrestling was verboten for sports entertainment. When you were doing your end for pay-per-views, titling, that sort of thing, were you aware of words that Vince or images that Vince absolutely did not want?
This is weird, but for some reason he didn't like the color green. He did not like the color green. And yeah, it was just for some reason. And that was something we always put into consideration. I think when we did a promo for D-Generation X, and it was like the DX with the green background, and we were like, you know, hope Vince likes it. But for some reason, the man didn't like green. That's all I can recall. But as far as words, again, you know, we would brainstorm those words that sounded aggressive. So we had, you know, a list, and it was, you know, without being, you know, too over the edge. And Vince would, you know, he would pick the one that he wanted. That was how it worked. I mean, he made every decision.
Did you ever propose something to him as a as sort of a rough that he absolutely either adored or hated and told you so?
You're putting me on the spot. I would say no. Vince was always pretty agreeable to our pay-per-view campaigns. He usually had a problem, hate to say it, with merchandising. He always had a problem with t-shirts. I don't know why. And they always were fantastic. But as far as pay-per-views, I mean, we had incidents where we would have to like change things on a dime because somebody broke their neck or somebody didn't sign their contract, or we were literally like, you know, stop the presses. And again, it's like, you know, we would have to like, who's our talent? Maybe Vince would say it's The Rock, throw him on there. And you just had to keep your fingers crossed that you picked the right shot. It's way after, you know, hours, and you're trying to get this to the printer on time. But sometimes, you know, you had to do what you best you could. Our saying was, maybe we all don't like this, but you know what? Next month, there's a brand new pay-per-view. There's a brand new key art. So we don't hold on to this stuff. It's not getting hung in a gallery. I used to always have to tell my team that because they were, you know, designers, but you know, I have to fight them all the time. Like they would like to make things look beautiful and, you know, typographically everything looked just right. And then I would bring it upstairs and they say, no, the time of day has to stand out. It has to be bold. And so those are the things that you go back and forth with, but that's, you know, the difference between like designing for marketing and, you know, making art that you're going to throw in a gallery. So, but we always found a common ground.
Isn't it weird? And I'm sure it's ultra weird for you imagining that company running now and him not being involved. Is that mad to you?
Now? I can't even imagine what it's like in there. I mean, I went to visit just a little over a year ago. I have a very good friend there. She's just did her 40th WrestleMania. God bless her. And I get together with her once in a while. So I know she's traveling now, well-earned. And when she comes back, I'm going to have to meet up with her because I know they've moved from the tower into their new headquarters. So I'd love to go inside and just see what it's like. But it's changed so much from when we were there. It was, you know, a hokey little, you know, corporate place. We all had our own little goofy side. We'd have like, you know, little art shows and galleries where we'd have like, everybody would bring in some of their best work and we would display it for a month. I mean, we were really like a very close-knit group. And I think things have changed so much. Everything's got so much faster and it's a lot less, you know, tight, like a family, like we were before, because, you know, granted we all sort of grew up together as the company became really successful. So, you know, we've experienced, you know, times where we thought, you know, they were going to lock the doors during the steroid, you know, scandal. I mean, we've all been through those scary times and you still, you know, you support the company because it's not only is it your bread and butter, but it's like, you love it. You know, it's like that we're family, we're in this together. So I have a weird story. Speaking of the steroid scandal thing. And this is a good like way to say, you know, this is who I was in the company. I've one of those people I'm probably not even remembered. I've always kept my, you know, my mouth shut, my ears open, always, you know, low profile under the radar. I'm a worker, get the job done. So when it was Vince's trial and I was asked by Vince and his lawyer at the time, I think he might still be his lawyer, Jerry McDevitt, before the trial, I had to make a display board that showed it that they would use in court to show this is the perspective of Vince's office and how the doctor's office was here and the eyesight that, and I had to like draw all the lines showing, you know, like this is, you know, could prove the case. I literally met with his lawyer and he like presented the entire defense to me and I had to go home because I couldn't even do it at my house because I have like a cat. So, and this is before, you know, you would do it digitally. So I had to go home with markers and draw on this big board, something that was used in the defense the next day. So that was the kind of relationship I had with the company. Like you were asked to do anything and everything and you were a soldier, you did it, you know, and that just was the weirdest thing I was thinking about. Like they had to explain the entire defense to me so they would understand how to make this visual aid. And I was like, okay. And I went home, I did it on my mom's kitchen table. So anyway, and it worked.
During this period, did you notice we've heard and read that there was a pallor over Titan Towers and Vince really was preparing to go to federal prison for a long time, bringing in Jerry Jarrett for a while, et cetera, et cetera. But did you notice in terms of the not only Mr. McMahon, but the other executives, that sort of feeling of dread? Was there a change in the atmosphere in the tower at the time?
You know, that was a long time ago. I do remember there were whispers that, hey, we could show up for work tomorrow and there could be, you know, a chain on the door and a padlock and we can't come into work. You know, so, I mean, we've kind of seen it all. There used to be people that would show up, you know, and protest in front of the building. We've had bomb threats. There's been, you know, all kinds of things that affected us at that corporate office. But I remember those days around that trial, really wondering if we were all going to have a job. And it was, I mean, we couldn't deny, you know, we all knew what was going on. I mean, you know, that was what was going on. You know, steroid use was rampant. That was, you know, anyone that you looked at in the ring, I mean, we all understood that. So it's like, oops, now it's dangerous and, you know, people are dying. So yeah, we have to come clean. I mean, I, at the same time, I also worked for our bodybuilding federation that Vince had launched, the World Bodybuilding Federation. So, you know, I went to see the first championship that was in Atlantic City. And again, those guys were literally juiced up. We all know that. The following year was the second championship, and this is after all the steroid stuff kind of broke and all these guys started to go natural. So it was like night and day. And I had actually a friend of mine, a coworker of mine, were flown out to California to work on the photo shoots immediately following the championship. And it was like all the guys were, you know, kind of complaining that, you know, this is not what they'd signed up for. So it was different times, but we all knew that, you know, steroids were infused into our business, you know, 100%. I mean, you know, and Vince McMahon out of anyone was like a monster. You know, I remember doing a photo shoot. It was my very first shoot. It was with the Hart Foundation. And I think it might have been Tom Buchanan, who you had recently interviewed. He might have been the photographer that day. And it was my first photo shoot with superstars. I was really excited. And I remember Vince McMahon showing up. This is at our TV studio. And he just put his arm, and you can see me. Yeah. So he put his like bicep in the door just to show the guys like, hey, you know, and it was like, I was like, wow, that's our boss. And he is jacked. So it was like, that was the, you know, the boys club kind of camaraderie, like, hey, you know, we had the gym, the in-house gym. And yeah, that was kind of the norm. But like I say all the time, but everything with this company, it was the 90s. These were different times. And, you know, I mean, they've taken a completely different route as far as health and safety. So, you know, we could talk about those days. It was a long time ago. But there was definitely an understanding by all of us that it's like, yeah, this might not work out. This is bad. But because I made that fantastic, you know, graphic, save the day. So thank you. you're welcome.
Quick sidebar. Did you work on the IcoPro campaign by chance?
I did. There was an art director that actually handled all of the packaging. But yeah, I did a lot of like photo shoots with her, and you know, I did the trade shows. We did a lot of like health and fitness, like personal fitness expos. And I actually worked on the booths, which was like a booth, which was like a royal pain in the ass. But, you know, we would go out to different places in the country and we would have to set up this mammoth floor space of a booth. And I'll have to share pictures with you. It was really, really heavy duty. But they had, you know, sports drinks and, you know, AIDS for gains or however, whatever. I mean, you can see how successful it was. But I think it was the company's way of putting a healthful spin on, you know, what we did in opposed to the direction that we want to go in. So it was a good effort. But yeah, anyway, I think there was only two bodybuilding championships. I think it only lasted altogether 2 years. I think the magazine only lasted. And usually they say after 2 years, it's like, you're going to cut it, or what are you going to do? And they cut it. So yeah, very short-lived, but interesting.
Did you have any memorable experiences? Maybe you touched on working with Tom on photo shoots. Did anyone stand out to you, maybe as a really nice person or a really funny experience with anyone during those times and photo shoots?
I did a wonderful photo shoot with Mick Foley after a very, very grueling cage match. I couldn't tell you which one it was, but I remember him being in an excruciating amount of pain, but he had to do a shoot for us that involved him for some reason lying on the floor in a very uncomfortable position. And I felt terrible, but he literally just gave it his all and then some, and, you know, went above and beyond. I just remember him being like really, really great to work with, despite, you know, the pain that he had put himself through that, just, I think it was just the night before. So sometimes the talent, you know, understands their role and will give it their all, and sometimes they don't. And I've dealt with some talent that didn't want to be there. So you got what you could, you know. It's like, it is what it is. I don't pick fights. I'm there to like get in, get out, get what you need. I'll, you know, I won't kiss their ass, but normally the nice thing to do is you get a feel for, you know, what they were doing the night before. How far did they fly in? Are they tired? Are they hungry? You know, is their wife pregnant, or, you know, what's going on? So you can make some nice small talk, and talent relations would usually like fill you in before your shoot. So you kind of like get a way to like, you know, get an in and make them comfortable. But I've always been like, hey guys, we got to get this done, you know, get in, get out. I don't dilly dally. And I think they always appreciated that. I don't want to suck up a lot of their time.
John Guiamondo, that you probably know as well, I've had on the podcast. He was called when wrestlers don't cooperate, he was calling it the Randy Orton.
Oh, he called it a Randy Orton? I've never worked with Randy. I didn't work with a lot of the superstars. I wouldn't dish on who was crabby or who wasn't. I think I met The Rock once in an elevator. It was at WrestleMania in Toronto, and I marked out on him so bad. I was so embarrassed because I was just me and him in the elevator, and I was like, I just want you to know, you know, it's like I work in creative services, and my name is. And he's like, I know who you are, I know who you are. And I was like, and I'm sure he didn't, but he was so, so nice and just so cool. And anyone that's worked there long enough to remember, you know, Rocky Maivia when he came in with that weird hairdo and the weird, and we were like, phew. I remember when he was on Saturday Night Live and crushed it. And I think we all came back to work that Monday going, he's a star. And then it was like, boom, Hollywood noticed. And then our other guys, I think Mick Foley and The Big Show, like they were on SNL and they all proved they've got chops too. So I think that's when we started to take ourselves a little bit more seriously as an entertainment company. So it started to really, like, you know, the wheels were in motion, and those were the years, man. We had, you know, Stone Cold and The Rock and Mick Foley, like Sacco, like all the crazy stuff that you couldn't go anywhere without seeing someone wearing a t-shirt, right? Like that, we were like a water cooler chatter. Like if someone was talking about wrestling, like someone's kid was watching wrestling, because again, there wasn't like 1,000 other programs on television. We were it. So we were so lucky to be a part of that, you know, to have such an impact on something that became so big, because we didn't have a lot of competition. You know, there wasn't like a million digital channels. So again, those were real golden years, and so, so lucky to be a part of it. Even though I look back at some of the artwork, and again, like I said, it's like, oh, some of it's so cringy, but it's like, even considering what we had to work with, we made some really cool magic as far as like stuff that fans, you know, my age and older really appreciate. You know, there is an interest in that old school stuff. And I'm so glad. I'm so impressed by the interest in it, really. I'm grateful.
Wanted to ask you from a creative standpoint, for your work and your division. You said you started right before WrestleMania 6 in Toronto, Hogan Warrior, and that sort of marked an investiture in the company with the Warrior, and then that didn't work out from, you know, the office perspective, and then Hogan eventually left in 94. And given the fact that from about 84 on, the company was so invested in Hulk Hogan as the property. What impact did that have on the work that you did in rethinking some of your go-to projects?
Well, I think we were fortunate that, again, we had, you know, the talent that were stepping up, like, you know, Steve Austin, you know, we were The Rock in itself, but there was also so much happening with, like, those really insane storylines that were, you know, very controversial at the time. So I think those didn't matter if Hogan was there or not. I mean, people were talking about wrestling because of things like, you know, dare I say, you know, Katie Vick, or, you know what I mean? Like those controversial stories. I mean, Undertaker, who, you know, like Hogan who, when it comes to, you know, that kind of, like, those superstar personalities. So yeah, I don't think we ever, like, you know, were, you know, worried or thinking that, you know, we're not going to survive this. It's like, there was always somebody new and better coming up the pike. And again, it's like, you know, Hogan, he came back. I mean, I remember he would be, like, standing out in the parking lot on the phone at the guard booth. And it's like, is Hogan coming in? Is he coming in? Is, you know, it's like, is he negotiating something? But I don't think any of us really felt like if he wasn't here, we weren't gonna, you know, survive or, you know, keep taking off. I mean, we proved that, obviously. So, you know, Hogan who? I mean, he put us on the map, God bless him, but there were so many more memorable, you know, talent that followed him, and I think, and yet I'm not going to take anything away from him either, but yeah, we never, it was, I don't, and to my personal experience, it was never a concern. If anything, every time we use Hogan, we have to use this giant trademark at the bottom of all of our copy, you know, it was like, so once he was gone, we didn't have to deal with that.
you mentioned there, of course, the Katie Vick storyline. What did you think when that hit, or was there anything that you thought, maybe they've gone too far this time?
Yeah, of course. But you know, it wasn't a big deal. I mean, like, because again, it was cable. It's like, you know, everybody was doing weird stuff on cable, and no one was really, like, getting a lot of backlash. And, you know, that was maybe bad backlash for us, but, you know, they say it's like, even bad publicity is good publicity. So it didn't matter. It really didn't, you know, it was kooky, but we all just said, yep, well, this is where we're going with this. I mean, there's been worse things down the pike. I, you know, like, what was it? May, what was her name? And there was, yeah. Thing. Yeah. So it's like, well, okay, that was Monday night, you know. And again, to be a woman in that industry, you really just have to check it at the door. It's like, there's no way you can be a prude or clutch your pearls. It's like, this is what we're doing, boys. You know, we're on this train. Let's just power ahead. It didn't matter.
Yeah, along those lines, I've heard you talk about your relationship with Classy Freddie Blassie, and some of the you know, the memorable moments that you had with him. Could you let the fans know what that entailed, and your thoughts on some of the what's the word, more blue aspects of
that? I'll say it clearly, and I don't mean any disrespect to his memory. You know, we all know, you know, he was a wrestling legend, and again, these were different times. But in my experience, I was, you know, young. I was maybe 24. It was, you know, very early in my career. It was part of my job responsibility. I worked for live events, and we would put inside each program, it would be the lineup. So you understood the card when you were at that event, who was coming in the ring first, what the main event was. And I worked with Howard Finkel. He was one of my point, you know, persons there. And before they would approve the card to go to print, I would have to get Freddie Blassie to, you know, read through it and approve it. So I had weekly meetings set up, and I would go over to his office, and, you know, he would say, you know, close the door. It was a closed door meeting, about a half an hour. And I just remember, you know, the first time I'd gone there, and he's a formidable man. He's, you know, he's a large man. He was you know, a legend. I knew who he was when I was going there. And he said, you know, close the door. And there was a couch in his office, a dirty couch. And he started making, like, you know, like little small talk. And he was like, oh, you know, if I can get you on that couch, oh, what I know what I'll do to you. And I'm like, ha ha ha. You know, but there was in his office from floor to ceiling, there was framed photographs. And there was a lot of pictures of him with celebrities from, say, his celebrity golf, you know, tournaments. There was pictures with him with, you know, the cast of the Dick Van Dyke Show, which I don't know if some of you guys wouldn't even know what that is. But so fortunately, I'm like an old Hollywood buff. So I was like, I recognized a lot of these people. So I was like, oh, Freddie, let's talk about, tell me about these people, how you know them. So that diverted his attention. And then it was like, finally, it was like, okay, what are we doing here? And he's like, I got a Playboy magazine. He pulled it out of his desk drawer. And he's like, you want to hear the jokes? So he read me the Playboy jokes. And then, you know, some weeks later, I would like take the magazine. I would read to him. We would just read the jokes to each other. And I got a kick out of it. And then basically he would like look at the card and say, yeah, that's fine. And it's like, okay, approved. So basically I had a meeting with him once a week to just read dirty jokes. Just keep them company for a little while. And honestly, I didn't mind. And after all these years, I just felt like it was just a kooky story that I would share, like, oh yeah, he's a wrestling legend. And, you know, he and I used to hang out in his office and read, you know, dirty jokes out of Playboy. And then now when you sort of look back, it's like, you know, it is kind of yucky. And it was the 90s. I would never, no one would do that now. No one would have asked a young girl to do that now. And so again, I said no harm, no foul. It's just, it is what it is, you know, but here Freddie, you know, he was a dirty old man, and he and that was just, you know, who he was. It was over years of being who he thought he was in the ring. That's what he was in his mind, I guess. So he did actually get in trouble at the office. He did do something I can't comment because I don't know the details, but he did something that obviously was serious enough for there to be, you know, somebody who supposedly got a payoff, and she left the company and she moved out of state, and, you know, more power to her. But they asked Freddie to not come into the office. He didn't have an office job anymore. And he was basically, you know, taken off the books, and it made it look like he was gone. But he wasn't, because he used to come and hang out in the mailroom. I mean, the guys in the mailroom were all around his age, and they would shoot the shit. And then someone would come up and say, hey, Freddie's downstairs in the mailroom. You want to come and say hi? And of course I did. I mean, I had nothing against him. I was like, I would go down and I'd show him my respect. So over the years, Freddie, you know, he did stay with the company. He used to be, you know, trot him out as Santa Claus. They would put Baird on him and put him in our cafeteria, and we'd have our company Christmas parties, and all the kids would get to sit on his lap, and some of the employees would sit on his lap, and I was no better, you know. But it was, again, like, we all kind of knew Freddie was Freddie, and again, it's like, it's having like a dirty uncle. It's like, you know, it's like, just don't get too close. And it's unfortunate, because again, I look back now and I think it's really disgusting, but at the time, and I'm sure, I who knows if I was the only one that was going to his office. No one said anything. No one made a big deal about it. It was like, just, you know, whatever. It's a funny story you can tell 30 years later, and here I am, you know. So yeah, but ew.
you mentioned celebrities there, and that just taught us something then I seen on your Instagram page, which we're going to tag underneath this, because you're going through some of these memories that you're sharing with us here now. Memories of Mike Tyson. Tom Buchanan said to me when he was at that, I think it was in New York. Did you go to that press conference? Yeah. Tom said, not a very smart guy. What did you think about him?
I didn't meet him. I mean, Tyson is Tyson. I mean, you know, maybe he's not the smartest guy, but he's Tyson. He's a legend. And aside from all the other bad publicity, I was really excited that he was doing something with WWF at the time. We were at that press conference. I was there with some coworkers from Creative Services, because we had to go out there and hang banners and make sure that everything looked right for camera. And when I had the opportunity to, you know, snap a picture, I went for it because we don't have the luxury of having phones with cameras on it back then. So, you know, if you wanted to steal a picture, you had to whip out your camera. And it just, again, I think I said in my video, it's like, I don't think that's cool. And you could see by the look on like the people that I caught in that photo, they didn't look too happy about it either. But again, it was with Mike Tyson, you know, it's not every day that there was a legend in our midst. So that was pretty cool.
In terms of shocking developments with the company from many, both inside and outside the industry as fans, when World Wrestling Federation lost that lawsuit with the World Wildlife Fund and the rebranding happened, that quite now iconic Get the F Out,
yeah,
and that whole campaign. Can you talk about when the reality set in that longstanding, you know, before it was WWWF, WWF, so classic, when the reality set in that it's now going to be WWE and all that entailed from your responsibility perspective?
Well, we did have a lot of fun coming up with all of those Get the F Out brainstorm ideas. And I take personal credit for the one where it kind of looks like from the Titanic scene, where like there's an F, I think, or something, and then like a hand comes up and like kind of wipes down. I mean, we had a lot of fun. Those are the things that we did in creative. It's like come up with like, you know, ideas to promote that we're no longer going to be the WWF. We're going to get the F out. Mm-hmm. One thing that was huge is because of the legal ramifications, we could not use WWF anywhere. So we had to literally take that off of everything, all of our old videos. And I remember it was an edict from Linda McMahon that if we used it, we were fined and we were in a lot of trouble. So, I mean, the fear of God was put into all of us to cover everything we did and make sure that there was no WWF logos on the signs, in the audience, on anything, on t-shirts. So we had to scrub it all. So that was a very busy time for all of us to acclimate to that. But we made the best of it because it really was a good way to launch ourselves seriously as an entertainment company. So getting the F out was a great idea. So, but yeah, it was dangerous to like let something slip that had a WWF on it.
How was that explained that this happened? Was it acknowledged that WWF violated the agreement with the World Wildlife Fund and promoted the business as WWF in Europe, or was it just we're just going to do this type of thing?
I couldn't tell you the legality of it. I mean, I just knew that it seemed to my impression we were on borrowed time, like we were using it as long as we could get away with using it until it just dried up. And again, the timing was probably right. So they let it happen when it did, because it really did help us segue into, you know, entertainment. So.
And speaking of entertainment, then of course during your time there as well, they started making movies. Were you involved in any of those and the design for any of those movie posters?
That was done outside, you know, production companies. So we didn't get to get involved with that.
Yeah, because I've seen the one.
We were a very, very small group, and we had a ginormous amount of responsibilities every single month, because every single month was a new event. And sometimes there was two pay-per-view events, and then sometimes they would throw in a, you know, a fan festival or a Hall of Fame or something. So we were always, always busy. There was never any downtime. The only time they would get a slight amount of downtime is right after WrestleMania, which is why my friend is traveling right now. It's literally around the clock, 24/7 promotional machine.
Yeah. Can you talk to me about, I listened to this on Brian's podcast, your No Mercy poster with Kane, the award-winning poster, if you want to explain that story to the people that haven't heard it.
Well, again, it's, I think, it was award-winning because it was different. It was dark. I mean, it's the mask itself, which is, in my opinion, a piece of art. It's funny that you brought that up because, again, like, you know, considering how that, like, the WWF becoming the WWE, we're starting to take ourselves a little bit more seriously as an entertainment company. as an art department or as a design group, you know, what we did was not respected. And here in Connecticut, we would have, there would be like a Connecticut Art Directors Club, and we would, you know, like, you know, promote ourselves and submit stuff, and they never took us seriously. But that No Mercy poster won a BDA, a Broadcast Design Award. So that was like, wow, there was a feather in our cap. I got a little award. It was awesome. And then we actually were in a Connecticut art director's show, that poster. So we were all excited, and we all went to the opening, and our poster was literally put on, like, leaning against a wall on the floor in some like obscure part of the gallery. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, they just didn't take us seriously as, you know, serious designers. So, you know, that's the role that you play. Even, you know, graphic designers in that business, people think, oh, you guys just go up to your desk and you press the buttons and you play with crayons and all that art stuff comes out. It's like, no, that's not how it works. So we are the underdogs mostly, but to be taken seriously out in the real world, they really just thought, oh, you know, wrestling is fake and what you guys do is corny. And they just didn't give us the respect that we deserved. Now I hope they do, because the work that I see, it is just absolutely stunning, the graphics that are being produced now. I've got to express that more and make sure that they're aware that some of the old timers are paying attention to what these new kids are doing. And it's gorgeous. So they deserve a lot of respect. They create beautiful graphics, and the live events are absolutely stunning. I mean, it's amazing what can be done. I mean, in the digital world, but again, we're going way back when, you know, we had, you know, banners and everything was like silk screened and just like eons away as far as like where we are technology wise.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about, you know, just how you know, nuts and bolts your work was without a lot of, you know, the technological advancements of today. And you had a lot of, you know, one of a kind pieces that are, you know, have historical value, and fans have seen tours of the large archive of the WWE, where they keep a lot of, you know, set pieces and et cetera, et cetera. Do you know where those one of a kind unique items that have such historical value that you were and your team was involved in prior to the dawn of the modern technological advances and storage systems, et cetera? Do you know where those pieces are by any chance?
Probably the trash. I mean, everything was like on boards. I've always told my coworkers for years, and I get together with them once in a blue moon. I always make sure that we kind of like have reunions. And I always say, I hope you guys saved your stuff. You guys have to share your stuff. And now, even if it just means, you know, taking photos and sharing it like I am, it's like, because it's gone. I mean, I seriously doubt that they archived any of the old stuff that's been saved on boards. So, I mean, I'm glad I grabbed as much as I did. I'm sure there's a lot of stuff out there. We all have probably stuff in our portfolios. But yeah, I don't think they took any real care in archiving things back then, unfortunately. So that's why I'm doing what I'm doing with the little, little treasure trove that I've saved. So,
is there any piece of work that you've done aside from the No Mercy poster that kind of you think maybe that's the favorite thing I've done in the WWF or WWE?
Ooh, my favorite thing that I've done. You know something? Here's the thing. I've done everything and done nothing. Like, when you're a creative director, you stand behind these fantastic designers and say, that's it. Or, you know, a little bit more, a little bit less. Like, you direct your team of designers. So, I mean, my hand is in everyone's work. My responsibilities towards the end of my career there was I did all of the annual reports, which are kind of dry. You get to do a few spreads that are kind of flashy, like, you know, magazine spreads, but that was really kept me busy almost the entire year. And then I would do some personal stuff for the McMahons, you know, birthday cards and invitations and stuff like that. But the work that my team did, the pay-per-view marketing team, was, you know, I was infused in all of it, you know, again, like our brainstorming. I always say we always did everything as a team. So, you know, all of their successes, my successes, we all shared it all together. So I couldn't say I have one piece that I was personally, you know, proud of. I think I talked about my Winky the Crow magazine ad. And again, you'd have to go look at my little videos. It's just like one little small ad that I did myself, had nothing to do with any of the superstars. It was just a mascot for Corn Nuts. And I wrote some copy, and it was just my little favorite ad. I'm so glad I kept it. But yeah, all of the work that I did personally, I can say I share all of those successes with my team. I worked with art directors, you know, production designers, you know, just an amazing team of incredible artists. So, you know, nobody works alone. We all, you know, we don't work in a vacuum. We all shared, and that's what, you know, creative director is responsible for, is the creative direction of everybody's work, making sure that it's done, that it meets the message that marketing wants, and it also looks beautiful. So,
could you talk about that very interesting story you have involving China that is such a wrestling type of situation, please?
China. Actually, I named China. We got a late night call. I was with an art director. It was after hours, and I think that it was, they were going to be on that night, and we took out a book, a baby names, celebrity baby names, and just went through the list. And China, who's actually China Phillips, I don't know if you would know the mamas and the papas, but it was like, what do you think of the name China? It's like, you know, it's strong, it's beautiful, and they went with it. So I adored China, and I was fortunate. I worked on a photo shoot with her and Hunter, and it was my campaign I designed, and it was, they had just kind of come out as a tag team. And if you recall, there was like a steam train, like a locomotive train behind them. And it was just about this like force coming at you, not to be stopped. And China had just sort of redid her look, her face. And I just thought she looked stunning. And I was just so proud, and I'm so happy for her. And her and Hunter, they were just like, they were having their moment. And it was really, I was really happy to be part of, like, you know, seeing her shine and being able to bring a pay-per-view campaign with them together. And then I just, you know, kind of, unfortunately, we saw how, where that went and how the soap opera of it all became reality. I remember being backstage, we were on the road, and we had to do a photo shoot for the Divas. There was going to be a huge banner on Times Square. And if you've ever seen this, it's, some days they do this in like men's bathrooms, where like women will be like kind of pointing down, like pose, but like, you know, oh, and that's what it was. The Divas were going to be doing this shoot. They're going to be featured in Times Square looking down and pointing, however. So the only one that didn't want to cooperate at that shoot was China. And she, I think she had just become a champion, and she was a diva. She wanted her own dressing room, and she was being really, really like a pain in the ass, but it was her moment, you know, like let her be. But it was the same time that it was coming out about Stephanie and Hunter, and that whole thing was breaking down, and we all knew it. And it was like so high school mean girl stuff. And I just remember China like being in her faux dressing room. It was probably an extra bathroom, and she didn't want to come out. And it was like, we have to do this shoot. And she was being a diva, but she was also dealing with a tremendous amount of emotional, you know, heartbreak. I can only imagine what it was like. So anytime I would see China, you know, whether it was like, you know, I think it was at the opening for the world. I mean, someone said, oh, you know, she always had a puss on her face. She always looked pissed off. Well, you know, can you blame her? She's got a, you know, a lot. She's carrying a lot, and she's working in the company where, you know, she has to face the people that, you know, kind of, you know, broke her heart. But sure as hell, she had an engagement ring on when I saw her when we were filming the a Super Bowl commercial, and it was done in our, and we were in a scene that was taking place in the lobby. And I remember her, she was, had somebody in a, like in a hole, like her legs were like wrapped around their neck or something. And in between takes, we were laughing and I saw her ring. So, you know, who knows? It's very sad. But you know, that's just another casualty of, you know, business that, you know, can eat you up alive. And it's unfortunate.
And she was way ahead of her time as well. She had a fantastic career.
Yeah. And again, I thought she was, what she did for her, you know, to be who she was. I mean, how dramatically she changed herself. It speaks volumes of how ambitious she was. So anyway,
you talked a little bit about Vince earlier. Did you have any other experience in working with the McMahons, whether it be Linda, Shane, Stephanie over the years?
Shane was always like a lot of fun. He was like, you know, recent college grad. He was always kind of like into the Beastie Boys and cool music. And he was just fun. I always thought he was just a good guy. I mean, he could be tough. I know people that worked in publishing, but hey, you know, he's a strong personality. I actually worked with his wife on something. She wanted to like create like an at-home kitchen cottage, little niche business. I remember designing something for her. I would always get called in to do like personal design stuff for people. Linda was always like the sweetest, you know, Southern hospitality. She was lovely. I did a lot of like personal work for her, you know, making posters for Stephanie when she wanted to like get tickets for a concert, or making birthday cards or retirement cards or little personal things, invitations for the McMahons. Vince was just always cool. He never treated me odd, never treated me weird. I mean, he would make some like little small talk conversations if we were alone, but I never felt uncomfortable around Vince. I was like, you know, I think he knew, you know, we're working here. we got stuff to do, and I got to get this approved so that I can get back downstairs and get it out so we can get this on press on time. Yeah. I mean, again, it wasn't what you might think. It wasn't this salacious place where, you know, everything was like going on behind closed doors. But yeah, there were some things that were going unchecked. And again, that was the 90s. So apparently they didn't learn their lesson. But where we are today is just, I've said it, you know, before, it's like I'm not surprised, only because of the experiences that I've understood, you know, were happening back in the 90s. You know, it was, again, we didn't have Me Too. There wasn't any like, you know, where you would, nowadays when you work in corporate, you have like sexual harassment training and you have to sit through, you know, a class and, you know, get certified that, you know, not to do stupid things on the job that you can get sued for or fired for. We didn't have that back then. So, you know, it was a free for all. And again, I've seen some things, I've heard some things, but nothing compares to what I hear now and what's been happening, you know, the last so many years. But that's a whole different podcast for another time.
Wanted to get your impressions of, or sorry, rather your feeling on the fact that, unlike several other, well, most entertainment organizations, entertainment companies, the folks that do the work behind the scenes, you know, you look at a movie and every grip is listed. And for some reason, the WWF, WWE has never credited so many people that are integral to the product. Two-part question. How did you feel about that from a career development perspective? And do you know where that long-standing edict came from? Because it really doesn't make sense in terms of detracting from the product.
That's a really good point. I honestly, I never thought about it, but I mean, there have been times where I've snuck my name into something really small, but yeah, I never thought about it until like in recent years. I think someone else brought up that point that we've never really been given, you know, credit. But I think, again, we're all just like, it's all one giant monster, and we're just one arm of it. So, you know, if it's moving in the right direction and it's making money and it's successful, it's like, I don't care. We're all part of that giant monster that's successful. It's like, I don't need my name to, you know, be on the end of a pay-per-view event or anything like that. It's like, you couldn't even begin to list everyone that really has a hand in it, right? I mean, it's everyone. So, yeah, it's not nothing. I think back then we you know, it wasn't a bone of contention for anyone. At least to my knowledge, it wasn't. Especially in the creative group, that was our job.
You touched on Brian's podcast also, and I know we're nearly a lot of time now. We'll wrap up on the hour mark about the Over the Edge poster and the memories around that with Owen Hart and your experiences around that time.
Yeah, I again, it was something that, you know, no one obviously reacts to that without horror. You know, it was just it was horrifying, and it snapped everybody into reality. It's like we're putting people in danger, and you know, you can see how it changed after that. It was just a horrible experience. I mean, I think Brian Pillman died, I want to say maybe that year or shortly before that. And I remember that kind of going around the company, and yeah, it was, you know, it was shocking, but you know, when Owen died, that was different. It's like, we all loved Owen. Owen was like everyone's little brother. Like he was the guy that you were rooting for all along. And it was so great to see him kind of come up through the ranks and earn his spot. And then, you know, to lose him tragically like that, we were stunned. We were absolutely stunned. And, you know, again, it's like we say we're family, and granted, it's like all those superstars, it's like we talk about them every day. We're looking at their pictures every day. We're wondering where they are. Are they on the road? So they are, you know, a part of our every day. And when we lose one, you know, so tragically like that, that really hit home for all of us. So I had talked about how I would got a request to make a flower arrangement to send to Calgary for the funeral, and I was honored. It was so sad, but you know, we made it in, like, you know, yellow and black, his colors, and I was asked to put a WWF logo in the center. So I had that arranged, and the concept was sent to, I guess, a florist over in Canada. And then I don't know if it was actually done and delivered to the funeral, but the word came back that Owen's widow wanted the WWF logo to be removed and to be have no mention, and completely understandable. And by all means, you know, so that was my little, you know, part of honoring Owen. You know, it was an honor to do that. But again, like that was a day we'll always remember. I wasn't there when we lost Eddie Guerrero, but I can imagine that was probably equally as horrible as far as like losing, you know, one of the superstars. It's one of the family. But yeah, Owen was tough.
Well, Debs, we really appreciate your time. This has been a fascinating look at a little understood and documented part of the business. I'm sure the fans really appreciated your insights. But along those lines, you've been talking about preserving some of your history, sharing it out there with the world. Where can the fans keep up with your work on social media or elsewhere?
I started a TikTok page, and I have an Instagram. You can find me. I call it Debs K Fables. All one word, Debs K Fables. And it's just, I'm kicking around. I've got a few videos that I made. I can post photos and, you know, and I'm not selling anything. I'm just preserving things. I mean, I literally cleaned out a storage unit, found a bunch of stuff. I said, before I put this all away and, you know, I get hit by a bus or something, let me at least record some of these stories. Cause I mentioned it to my other coworkers, and I hope they hear this. I'm going to put the word out Again, I am not the only person that's saved stuff. So, and I am a pack rat. I've saved a lot of stuff. I'm sure there's other stuff out there. And for every, you know, ad, every ad select, every poster, there's a story. And I've got a lot of them. So I'll be happy to share them. So it's Deb's K Fables. And I look forward to hearing how successful this podcast went. And I want to thank you again for having me. I really appreciate the attention. It's weird, but I love it. Thank you.
much like you said there, we like to preserve history on this show by talking to as many different people as we can from many decades. And we've had camera persons on, art directors, photographers, yourself. I think it's good to get everyone's story out there as well. And that's what we're trying to kind of document on this channel. So really appreciate your time today.
Thank you for doing it. Thank you. Awesome.
Well, fans, that's it for another edition of the Cheap Heat Productions Pro Wrestling Podcast. I want to thank our guest Debs again. And for Morris Shorthall, I am Jack Kilby. Thank you for watching, and we will see you next time.
Bye, everybody.